From KQED Public Radio, this is Capitol Notes, our weekly podcast about California politics and increasingly just about the state budget. I'm John Myers from KQED. Anthony York, the editor of Capitol Weekly, scribbling on his piece of paper here in the studio.
And it's an etching.
And we're doing an experiment today.
This is it.
Should I reference it?
That's our little experiment.
Okay, so Anthony's brought a little flip camera in here. Anthony's you've gotten really into this
budget,
multimedia something.
Budget tech.
So we're going to try it out.
Yeah.
The video may never see the light of the day, but we've referenced it here on the podcast. I don't know that people really want to watch us doing this.
That's weird. So, I don't want to watch Don Imus do it either, but MSNBC still puts it on
and
the
I'm going
air.
To get a great big cowboy hat like him.
I think that's a good idea.
Sit here and talk like I've had 14 cigarettes.
Now, let me ask you about the women's basketball team.
Okay, let's go to the budget quickly before people just completely say they've got the wrong podcast this week. Okay, so we've got some budget news to talk about. It was an interesting week in budget coverage. So the Democrats have put out their plan now. Democrats have their full plan. The conference committee ostensibly finished its work. We're going to have floor votes next week, Monday or Tuesday, in the Assembly and Senate. This is Act 2. Of the traditional three-act drama. Act one was the, oh my God, we have problems. Act two now is going to be the fight and beating our chest and my version, your version. Sometime we'll get to act three, I guess, which is resolution. But this feels like a long act two.
Well, and this is also the act two where, cue the Republicans, right? This is where the Republicans get to participate.
Dramatic music comes in.
Act one is really... We could probably splice that in on
the
video.
We could. Anyway.
Act one really was the governor and the conference committee, which is, in effect, the Democrats. The conference report that was adopted this week, a $23.2 billion proposal that includes tax increases and a $15 new car tax to pay for state parks and new taxes on oil production and tobacco, about $2 billion worth. Shallower cuts than the governor proposed in health and welfare and other programs, the safety net programs. The Republicans have been mostly silent on this. We've heard a little bit from the two Republican leaders, Dennis Hollingsworth and Sam Blakesley. But remember, this is their first go-round in the budget for both of them. And I think that there is some measure of them trying to find their footing and articulate what they want. I just spoke with the former Assembly Budget Vice Chair Roger Nilo, who indicated that budget reform is going to be part of the Republican demand list. And so anybody who was with us in December,
you've seen this play.
Roll tape, Yeah. I mean, I think that... And that's what's so hard to know about this week is this the shell of a deal that can be hammered out, the over $2-3 billion of which can be hammered out in leadership negotiations, or are we on the verge of blowing up and starting over?
Well, let's back up and for those who weren't following it, kind of give a brief overview of what we've got. So you said it right. The Democrats have about a $23 billion solution, as they call it. The governor has about a $24 billion solution. I would argue that part of that goes to this rhetoric that the governor has out there about, I need an entire solution. So the Democrats will argue, we've given you an entire solution. We're within, I don't know, whatever margins you would call it. Interestingly enough, though, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, but $2 billion of that solution will never get off
the floor
of the legislature.
But what's interesting about it is when you break it down beyond that number, you see where we're going. The Democrats have about $11.4 billion in cuts. The governor would have about $16 billion in cuts. The Democrats have a $2 billion tax, which I want to talk about in just a moment. The governor has Zippo, theoretically, though the governor does have some tax increases in his. They're just not being portrayed the same way.
And the governor has $2 billion of borrowing from local government, which is the same dollar figure, so sub those out.
Democrats have about $7.5 billion of what are called revenues, fees, and shifts. The governor has about $4.8 billion there. Democrats want to cut about $4.5 billion out of education. The governor wanted to cut $5.2 billion out. What I find fascinating, though, is let's go to the reserve issue, because the reserve was this hot-button debate for, I don't know, about a week, it seemed like last week. Where, it was a debate of, is the governor's reserve fair? Could you put that much in reserve when the state's in the hole? et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the Democrats have a $3.8 billion reserve compared to the governor's $4.5.
Right.
Interestingly enough, the tax increases, the $2 billion in taxes, the oil extraction fee and the tobacco tax, are ostensibly all put into the reserve. Therefore, I think trying to squeeze the governor, would you say, fair to say?
Yes.
Look, if you want a reserve, Governor Schwarzenegger, of that size, you've got to raise taxes. We're not going to create a reserve by cutting social programs, completely eliminating some of them like CalWORKs.
But, and this gets back to what we've talked about before, about whether or not this is a reserve. I mean, you know, the state controller, or well, really more the treasurer, Bill Lockyer, has said, this isn't a reserve, this is a reflection of the new realities. Look, our revenues are going to be short, so unless you're going to have a deficit, that it's like saying we know that we're going to be $3 billion short at least. I mean, we're just in the very beginnings here.
And could be worse from what some people are saying.
But. So unless you want to move that $3 billion into next year's deficit automatically, you need to either make deeper cuts or have new revenues to reflect our new revenue realities, which are $3 billion shorter than where we were when we started this, even in May. So, you know, I think it's a confusing issue, and I don't know how this plays out inside the Capitol or let alone outside. But I do think politically that's where the Democrats are headed on those taxes. I think you're absolutely right.
Well, let's look at a couple of other things inside the Democratic package. Let's talk about the cuts. They clearly, as you said, they're shallower, I think it was your term, and they're right. They rejected a number of the governor's cuts that Democrats just could not find any way that they were willing to do. They've accepted some things of the governor's that do seem questionable. One of them that you talked about, and is interesting, is the supposed cut in Medi-Cal.
$1 billion.
Talk about that, because talk about what the governor was trying to do and why it's interesting the Democrats have just accepted it.
Well, this is a cut that came out later from the governor. I believe it was after his May revision. He talked about eliminating $1 billion from Medi-Cal. I could be wrong on that. These are cuts that the Democrats have opposed in the past.
And it requires federal waivers.
And you need a federal waiver.
Right.
So you need a change in federal law because of the way the stimulus package works. California has to provide services in Medi-Cal that are at least equal to the level they provided them in 2005. So they want to go $1 billion below that level here, or they at least want to be able to score the savings of that $1 billion in cuts. And they need the feds to do it. Now, Democrats have said in the past they don't support the federal government stepping in and changing that requirement. They don't support those Medi-Cal cuts. So it's kind of interesting to see that snuck in there, you know, at the end of the Democrats' proposal. You know, I'm not going to say it's disingenuous, but it reflects a change in attitude if we're to take it at face value.
Well, and I was going to say, if you try to look at it in terms of the strategy of Act Two, it reflects a notion that this is not the end all be all. This is the beginning of their counter to wherever we're going to go to negotiating this out, right? Because, I mean, if you scored $1 billion without really accepting where it's coming from or even really having a public discussion about it, it just seems like to me you're trying to get a number that you can go into negotiations with. You know, the big number's 23, 24. You know what I mean? It doesn't feel fully cooked.
Yeah, well, or you could argue since both proposals have it, I mean, the Democrats are saying, hey, we're just mirroring the governor here.
Right.
So you could look at it another way and say both sides are writing this money down in savings. You know, there are other things in here like a partial sale of the state compensation insurance fund. You know, we've seen these proposals that get written down as sources of revenue or cuts that will be made that most people know full well will never materialize. So,
well, and that aren't real money. I mean,
right.
let me just mention another one. The proposal has a one-day shift in paychecks.
Right.
Now, average people, bear with me a moment.
Both of you, right?
The rest of you already know this. Go have a cup of coffee. But so the state would issue paychecks to all state workers, people who work for the legislature, executive branch, on June 30th, at the end of the month.
In a normal year.
June 30th also happens to be the last day of the fiscal year. Now, we're talking that this is primarily all geared to deal with the year coming up.
Next June.
They say it's a permanent change, but
You only get the savings this one time.
So here we go. June 30th, 2009, instead of getting your paycheck, you would get it the next day, July 1st.
Right.
Well, maybe you don't think that's a big deal because it's 24 hours. But to state government budgeting, that counts as the new fiscal year. So the $1 billion that those paychecks are worth would get counted in the next fiscal year, thereby saving you $1 billion in the fiscal year that ended. Complete gimmick. And with all due respect to the Democrats, they say these kinds of things have happened before. They sure have. They sure have. It's not unusual. But total, complete gimmick that I think just goes to show, again, the difference in what you and I live in our world about our finances and the state government lives in its.
And euphemistically, I mean, you look through the governor's proposal or the Democrats' proposal, that you will see categories of deferred payments, right? And that's what this means. You defer the payment for a day and you move it into another quarter, into another fiscal year. You see that happen with education, quote unquote, cuts.
Yeah, that's
all
a great
time.
Example. That's happened a lot.
Yeah. So this is not new. I mean, you know, once again, whenever something like this comes out, and there's always something in every budget proposal, there's always something where you just sort of, those of us who cover this full time, you got to appreciate the artistry, at least. Right.
Right? You've got to give them like a 10, score on artistry.
You know, I don't know if this one's a 10. I think the revenue neutral December package, that was a 10.
That's
that
a
was
10.
Good.
This is about a 6.
Yeah, this is a 6 or 7. But who knew that was there, right? So, you know, we learn more and more about the details of our budget every time we get one of these things. But I think the fundamental question is, you know, with all these things, revenue with accelerating the collections on withholdings for independent contractors and corporations, all of these revenue accelerations, which are really one time, you get the benefit one time. What are the long-term implications for the budget, and how much in quote unquote real solutions are we talking about here? Even in, you have these lofty numbers being kicked around, $23 billion, $24 billion. How real is any of it? And I know the governor's out there on the stump saying, hey, we're going to do it for real. We're not, no more gimmicks. No, he's back to kicking the can down the alley, right?
Yeah.
No more can kicking. But really, it doesn't hold up. I mean, the governor came out yesterday after meeting with Democrats, or earlier this week after meeting with Democrats about their proposal, and said, well, we're not going to have any new fees or taxes or one-time solutions. Well, guess what?
Yeah.
His budget, guess what his budget has?
To which he fees. Then clarified, and he said, well, no more than what we already have.
Right. So, again, and that was only after a reporter's question. And so it's a little disingenuous. I mean, I think, you know, how and I think it reflects a reality that no matter what happens here, this is not going to be the last time and the last year that we're talking about this stuff.
Well, let's talk about the governor, where the governor was on it this week. So, right, by the end of the week, the governor said, I'm going to veto any tax increase. I'm going to veto anything that doesn't come that's not a full solution to my desk. Same example, kicking the can down the alley is kind of one of his favorite phrases of the last several months. He's used it all week long. He used it Monday afternoon. I sat down with him for my annual. You get like an annual interview with the governor.
Did you bring cookies?
I did not. He had cookies in there, actually. Aww. He had a whole tray of cookies, and I didn't want to take a cookie.
Sorry, governor. I know.
Exactly. But what was my point?
I don't know.
But in that conversation, it's about a 20-minute interview. There's a link on the website if somebody wants to hear the whole exciting thing. But
Where can I find that? What's the URL?
That would be californiareport.org. Okay. Thank you. Good. See? Cross-promotion.
There you go.
But I asked him about this notion of solving what you could agree on fast and first rather than this whole thing. And he said, well, you know, again, kicking that can down the alley. We don't want to do that. We want to solve a larger problem. But this gets to a point that came out with the Democrats. And I think this is the Democrats seem to me to be involved in a serious bit of strategy. Last week, you and I talked about the differences in the Assembly and Senate. They seem to have reconciled some of the differences that we were talking about before about exactly what package they put out. But let's talk about a strategy difference that seemed to pop up in the middle of the press conference you and I were sitting in on Wednesday about how this would move forward. Now, all of these proposals are in separate bills. There's six or seven bills that would be voted on. The cuts are in a bill. The taxes are probably all in one bill, et cetera, et cetera.
Because this is not a budget, remember.
This is a revision to a budget. It's not an actual budget. Then the question becomes how many votes you need to enact these. And technically, you only need a majority vote to enact the cuts. But if you want the cuts to take effect immediately, it's an urgency clause. You need a two-thirds vote, which means you need Republicans, which gets back to how do you get Republicans on board. But I asked the legislative leaders in that press conference, I said, would you send, you know, would you, if you can't get the taxes, if you can't get Republicans to vote yes on the taxes, would you send the cuts only if you had to do them normal, they only take effect in 90 days? Would you send the cuts themselves to the governor for his signature? Now, one way that could put pressure on the governor about this whole notion of, am I going to reject a $14 billion solution that helps the state pay its bills now? Am I going to reject it and the state kind of goes into chaos, or am I going to hold fast and say, you know, where am I going to sign it? But it also puts the Democrats in a weird position because the Democrats lose their leverage on the taxes if they move the cuts forward without the taxes. The only way they get any leverage, theoretically, the only way they would get leverage on the tax increase is to say you don't get the taxes, you don't get the cuts until we get the taxes. So when I asked the question, would you send them forward, Assembly Speaker Bass said, we're sending the governor a package. And I don't know if you noticed, but very quickly, Daryl Steinberg, the Senate pro tem, said that, you know, we're not saying that. We're not saying that we won't send individual bills to him.
But it'll be a package of cuts, right?
Yeah, but you know, because this is a parliamentary procedure, but it's also a very important policy one because, you know, this gets back to the notion of do you do what you can do fast because we are screwed, or do you hold out for the high ground, the moral high ground of a full solution, even if it means the state really could be in the dumps?
And I think that some of that answer is going to depend on what people like the state treasurer and the legislative analysts say, and the controller, over whether if we had a tax package. And look, the Republicans aren't going to go for any of these revenue accelerations either, I don't think. It doesn't look like it. And that goes for the revenue accelerators that, and fees that are in the governor's plan, which are about $2.8 billion, and the $5 billion or so in the Democrats' plan. You know, Republicans aren't going to put up votes for that, so they'll have to do it in a special session, which will mean that it'll go into effect within 90 days of passage. So, so I think we are talking about at least some portion of this budget getting passed without Republican support. But I think that it will be an interesting test to see if and when some of these cuts go down without the taxes. Look, Democrats don't have leverage on taxes. Taxes are a non-starter. I think that that's clear. But that's not to say there won't be tax increases.
Right. But if they had any leverage at all, it would have to be attaching them to the cuts. And I agree with you. I don't think there's much leverage. But I'm just saying, when you agree to split them apart, you automatically concede that the taxes are dead.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, most of us already have made that concession that the taxes are dead, and that, you know, it was important, I think, for Assembly Democrats to at least, or and Senate Democrats as well, they both are going
to
adopt these tax increases
or
push them. Yeah, to at least articulate and to push back against the idea that this budget should be all about cuts, which you know, on its face, you look at some of these other ideas that are in there, and with or without taxes, this budget is not just about cuts. But the taxes aren't going anywhere. You know, could we see local government funding come back into play? I mean, is it just a coincidence that Democrats proposed $2 billion in tax increases and that the $2 billion was the figure that the governor had for borrowing from cities and counties?
Do you think, therefore, trying to get cities and counties to lobby for the tax increase
maybe,
because it's better than them getting borrowed from?
It could very well be. But remember back in December when the Democrats proposed a package of taxes, and they actually sent them down to the governor on a 41-vote basis, where you lowered one tax, you lowered a gasoline tax, you raised other taxes like the oil severance tax and
the majority vote tax, the immaculate tax.
And then
tax.
You replace it with a fee.
Right.
You could see something like that happen. Now, the governor sort of dug in deeper earlier this week when he said, look, I'm talking about no new taxes, no new fees, no new anything, parentheses above and beyond the stuff that I've already proposed, all the new taxes and fees that I've proposed. So, and by taxes, I mean the governor has a property tax in there to pay for firefighting, which Republicans are not going to support. So, you know, these are sort of the issues. I think the main issues still on the table are the future of local government funding, whether that $2 billion gets taken away, funding for parks. Democrats want to pay $200 million for parks out of a $15 per car vehicle license fee, which Republicans don't support.
Which would get you in free to most parks, not all parks. Basically, if you have a California license plate, you'd get in free to the park.
Right. But the state would be able to back out its general fund support of those parks. Republicans don't support that plan. Would they support something else, another fee or some other sort of fee to pay for state parks that is not an increase in the car tax? These are some of the main questions that I think we're still dealing with. Local government, parks, and the issue of revenues and the depth of the cuts. The governor proposed about $680 billion more in education cuts than the Democrats did. It's worth noting that all the Democrats' cuts that were proposed in education can be backfilled by federal stimulus dollars this year if they spend all their federal money in 1 year. And so will Republicans ask Democrats to go deeper and cut certain things? And will they be and what sort of leverage do Republicans have? I mean, in terms of holding the line, if votes go up for certain budget cuts, will Republicans back off and say no because we don't get our because they're not deep enough?
And I was going to say, too, we haven't heard yet from the huge interest group world. We haven't seen a ratcheting up completely.
Are they cast in Act Two?
Yes, they are. They are an ominous figure in Act Two.
The Greek chorus.
We can think about that, but not just those interest groups. I mean, interest groups on the right and left. Right. For example, we're just starting to hear from some of them. Came out on Thursday. An email from a group of special narcotics agents in the State Department of Justice who work on interagency issues, including the Mexican drug cartels influencing California. They have a newspaper ad they're going to put out next week that says Mexican drug lords, will be coming into California if you cut the $20 million for the Bureau of Narcotics Enforcement out of the State Department of Justice.
Is that going to be running in Capital Weekly?
I don't know.
Well, we should get people on that.
You should get on that. I looked at the camera when I said that and pointed. Anthony's salespeople, you know where to go. But the point is, we have not heard from the interest groups who will say you are going to kill fill-in-the-blank program if you do this. And that's going to be a pressure point, too, in the next couple of weeks to see how that plays out. Law and order, social service programs, labor unions, business community, the issue of the tax credits that we haven't even talked about. The Democrats want to roll back some of the tax credits that were in the September package, which also take a two-thirds vote because that's technically a tax increase. There are all kinds of pressure points that are going to be put on this debate in the next couple of weeks. And where I think we have to go, because we're going to get long on this podcast, is how long do we have to have this debate? How long can this go on? This is not a constitutional issue this summer like it is every year where we're like, well, we blew the constitutional deadline. This is a real – we are – if you believe what the controller and everybody says, we're screwed. We have no money in July. We have less money in August. We can't pay the bills. We've got lots of problems. So how long can the debate go on?
Well, and this gets back to what we were talking about earlier about do you have to do it all at once, or could you do a piece of it at a time?
Are you willing to do it? Right.
Right. And I think that those practical realities as well as those strategic decisions are going to sort of play out over the next week or two here, and as we approach July 1st.
And this notion of the money of getting borrowing from Wall Street, because effectively, for those of you who don't remember, the whole point of getting this done fast is we're supposed to be able to show Wall Street, look, we've got some credible solutions here, so loan us the money we need to cover our short-term cash crunch. We got a small bit of that played out this week, and I think we should just talk about it briefly. So I think it was Monday or Tuesday. It was Tuesday. The White House press secretary, Robert Gibbs, was asked a question about California. This was following a Washington Post story that ran on Monday. Listen to me like a broadcaster. On Monday that effectively said the White House says, California, you're on your own. Because what we've been asking for is a guarantee of our borrowing.
Right.
We're not asking for money, even though the national discussion has made this seem like we're asking for money for a bailout. We're technically just asking for a cosigner, I think, as you called it, on our borrowing from Wall Street. The White House said we're not in a position to do this. We're not. We think California's got to work on the problem itself. So the problem here, though, is that the White House has also said before that Congress needed to give us authorization to do that. Right. Well, there is legislation that we've talked about on the podcast that Barney Frank, congressman from Massachusetts, has put forward that would give that co-signer authority to the federal government. But that legislation isn't moving very fast. And there are a lot of people here in Sacramento, in state government, who know that we probably won't get it in time. And we probably won't get, even if they agree to it, in which case, all of this almost becomes academic. We could show Wall Street everything, but if the banks aren't going to guarantee our loans, which is what we have to do, then what? Or well, how much are they going to charge us?
And what's still unclear is at what point do we need the loans? I mean, the numbers that come out from the controller and the treasurer are saying, if we do nothing, we will be $1 billion in the hole by the end of July. Well,
that's fine.
We're not going to do nothing. So we're going to do something. And so what if we don't do it all, but we do a piece of it? You know, where are the...
What if we do $5 billion, $10 billion, $15 billion?
Right. And I'm sure that depends on the types of cuts that are made. And, you know, the education cuts happen immediately and when the schedule of certain payments. And so that's a much more complicated and nuanced question. And I think that I hope those discussions are going on somewhere. But it doesn't offer much clarity for those of us who are trying to understand the actual cash flow situation and how the cuts and new revenues, sort of the overlay of that on our cash problem, how that all fits together is still, I think, unclear to everybody.
And the timing is important, again, just to try to make it clear for if we've lost our three listeners. Though people tell me we have more than three now, and maybe we'll have some people on video. But the timing is so important because the controller has said, the one other thing that he has said is that we run out of cash somewhere around the third week of July.
Right.
Well, we're now sitting here in the back half of June. He has to have a process to go to Wall Street and ask for the borrowing as it is. That can't happen in 24 hours. There's a process of documents and forms and requests and everything. So back timing all of this. How long does Act 2, as I called it at the beginning of the podcast, have to play out? How long does this lovely dramatic play have before it's academic and it's too late and we don't have good you know what I mean?
That's what we don't know. And some of this, I think, is in the controller's discretion. I think we'll hear more if this budget standoff goes on for a while past July 1st. We'll hear more and more from the controller because the controller has a fair amount of discretion on what payments to make. So if we don't have a cuts in revenue package in place and we don't have the short-term borrowing secured, you know, the Constitution is pretty clear. We have to make education payments and debt service first.
Of course, after that, it gets fuzzy.
And then I think that the controller can make some decisions to withhold certain payments. And so, you know, let's hope we don't get there. But I think, you know, if we're still talking about this in 2 weeks and we're not wrapping up the deal that was struck, this is what we're going to be talking about.
Seems to put the controller in a very powerful position.
Yeah, but is it one that you'd want to be in?
I don't know. I don't know what role he plays in this drama.
He cuts the checks.
Right. Yep. But we need to assign him a character. You know, you had the Greek chorus. You had the... I don't know.
I'm not up on my Shakespeare enough to know, like, where a good Shakespearean...
Someone will let us know. Will let us know.
Yes.
Well, we'll be back for Act 2 next week. We think there's going to be budget votes, floor votes early week, so by...
To vote or not to vote?
That is the question. And on that... That's this week's Capital Notes podcast. I'm John Myers from KQED. That's Anthony York from Capital Weekly. Is your video still working?
Was it ever? I don't know.
We'll find out. It'll be on YouTube. We'll see you next time.